This is Colourful.
Some have written of him, he's photogenic. He's a showman. He is the quality son of a diplomat. He's moved effortlessly into a pivotal role at the crossroads of architecture. His close friends include the Turner Prize winner, Chris Ofili. What else has he done? Well, this man has done many, many things indeed. And I tell you what, he's right here in the studio. His name is David Ajay. David, good morning to you.
Good morning, Henry.
Now, here's a quote. For rich people, we make things grittier. For poor people, we make them glossier. Discuss. What do you mean? That is so deep. That is so deep.
I like that.
That was my starting point when I started my career. I just thought that architecture really had to support community and had to support the empowerment of people that didn't have. And in a way, you know, with architecture, you are at one point with super wealthy people who are patronizing amazing projects with a lot of money, and then you're with people who have incredible ambition, as much ambition as those without money, those with money, but they don't have the economic means. So for me, this idea that, you know, one would not charge the same fee for the same groups, you know, I mean, you could argue that you could have standard fees like lawyers and solicitors,
but I
would basically say that, you know, if the cause was worthy, I would do it, and I would try to help as much as possible, and vice versa. It's a silly thing.
Just thinking about some of the buildings for which you're known, I mean, there are many outside this country, but which ones would you say you're most proud of here in this country? Because, of course, there is an ideas store in Shoreditch. You've got the Stephen Lawrence Centre. There are several buildings, but which one do you think, this is mine?
They're all
people
really
need to see me in
me.
This.
I think that what's kind of amazing is that the buildings that I did in this country in the last 15 years are really important to me, because they talked about a moment in Britain where we've always been part of the Black British community, but our voices have been heard in stations, in literature, etc., but not in architecture. And for the first time, at the beginning of the 21st century, we started to build monuments that talked about our lives in this community, permanently in this community. And that's what architecture does. It writes the stories of our lives into the fabric of the city. So, you know, from the Bernie Grant Center, which is a really important center, and celebrates an incredibly important man who broke through a glass ceiling for a lot of people, right through to Stephen Lawrence's monument, which is so pertinent. The center and foundation is critical, because not only is it a building and a sort of education space, but it's also a monument really to him, and that's how it was conceptualized.
Yeah, I'm just thinking about some other projects. The Nobel Peace Center in Oslo, the Performing Arts Center in Boston, New York's Museum of Contemporary Art, and a similar building in Denver. How do you do all this? I mean, you know, it's one thing to be commissioned for the Bernie Grant Centre, the Stephen Lawrence Centre, an idea store, Innova, that's right as well, you did that one as well in Shoreditch. But to have a reputation that goes way beyond these shores, to Singapore, to California, and then to Washington, and we'll come to that in just a moment or two. How does that happen?
Well, what's kind of amazing is that I think when you do work that touches and resonates with communities, the community speaks about it. And what I mean, the first big international project was the Nobel Peace Center. And I remember when we were in our office working away, you know, in London, thinking nothing of it, and we got a fax. Then when faxes were the way people communicated, we got a fax through. And I remember my assistant coming up to me and going, "Oh my God, we've just got a fax from the Nobel Peace Center." We didn't believe it. We thought it was somebody just playing around. And then we had a phone call, and we were invited to take part in an international competition, and we won it. And we got to meet the whole team that run the Laureate system, and discovered how amazing that thing was. We were prepared to do just their bathrooms for them. You know, we were so excited. And we realized that we'd won the competition to develop the space for the Laureates and the history of the Laureates, which was really fantastic.
When I was walking in this morning, I was thinking that I must ask you this. How does it happen on the whole in terms of you being commissioned to do projects? Do people come knocking? Do you get that fax or that text or email? Or are you invited to be part of competitions? Do you put out to tender, I don't know, several architects firms? How does it work?
It works across almost all those platforms. I mean, as you get a bit of a name, you get people come to you because they know who you are. Mm-hmm. But actually, a lot of what young architects do is to really enter competitions, to enter what they call requests for information that are being sent out by councils and community groups all the time to kind of ask for people's services. So this is something that's really part of our business. But actually, what happens when you're lucky and you start to get a name is that, you know, it starts to reverse the other way. You don't have to go out so much. People start to come to you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Let's move to 2009, because this was when you were selected in a competition to design the National Museum of African American History and Culture.
Yes.
That is massive, isn't it?
It's the dream commission of my career. It's the biggest thing that has happened in my career, but it's also one of the biggest things that happens in architecture, in the sense that that sort of commission only comes about once every generation.
Yeah.
Really once every generation. But also, for me, it was even more pertinent, even more precious, because it was really a commission about, you know, finally memorializing and paying tribute to the extraordinary history of African American people. I mean, there is a Jewish museum to the Jewish culture, but actually the struggles of the African American community, their kind of forced move from the continent across the Middle Passage to the South, to the Caribbean and to the Americas, before the South of America, before kind of becoming mainstream America, is a really powerful story of, you know, trials and triumph, really, I would say. And in a way, that community, I would argue, has single-handedly somehow, through their tribulation, emancipated the world through certain modern ideas, like the civil rights. The civil rights comes about, which emancipates the rest of the world, because of the struggles of a small group of people who go and transform the world. So in a way, I think that their story is really powerful, and something that, as Black people, we need to be really proud of. And I'm just so kind of honored that I am part of the story in terms of making the building which starts to celebrate that.
It's amazing.
Can
you tell us, David, anything about the design?
Yeah.
You're allowed to.
I am. Now I am. We've been allowed to kind of.
David is currently blushing in the way that only a
Black man. A Black man blushing. Terrifying.
Yeah, go on. It's not terrifying. It's all right.
It's cute. Go on. Tell us about the design.
Well, you know, for me, it's really important that, like, buildings which talk about people's histories reflects those stories. So the building for me takes its cues from. For me, the high culture that was around that sort of, you know, from the kind of 17th century onwards, you would argue that probably the culture that was at its high point was the Yoruba culture. Yoruba culture was, for, you know, 1,000 years, really the zenith in West Africa, and really like the epitome of political, social, and artistic creativity. So I said that, you know, even though the diaspora comes from, you know, as far ranging as Senegal to Angola, you know, a lot of the diaspora come from Nigeria, Nigeria and Angola really are the largest density. And then you have Ghana, and then you have Senegal, et cetera, et cetera. But I thought that there would be something very beautiful about referring to the architecture, the shrine architecture of the Yoruba kingdom. So the building is based on the crown of the Caryatids, which is the sort of sculpture, the sculptures of the kings that is carved onto the buildings, and their crown motif. Because in when I came to the competition, I mean, a lot of people who went to the competition were talking about the trials and tribulations of slavery and the, you know, the passage of water. And I said, you know, that's one part of the story. Mm. The story is a bigger thing. And actually, for me, what is amazing about the story is it talks about triumph. It
Yes.
talks about a spiritual triumph. That actually there's been a lot of people who have fallen, but actually there's also been an extraordinary emancipation. So this is really about a crowning achievement. It's not about, you know, respite. It's not saying it's finished, but it's about a crown. So in a way that, you know, old sculpture would make a king and then tell his story with the carvings of the king's tails around the sculpture. I said this building had to play the same story, use the same metaphor, because that's the tradition of West Africa.
Yeah.
You would carve the king's tails, and the king this time is the African-American people. So it's the crown motif is the form of the building, and then the content is inside and underneath it.
What strikes me listening to you, David, and you put that so beautifully and eloquently, right? You can't just be a designer. You can't just be an artist. You have to be a historian as well.
I think that with architecture, it's incumbent upon you to know history.
Yeah.
History is critical, because history is what makes meaning out of the creativity. You know, I mean, I think at the beginning, the creativity is important, but on its own, in its own abstraction, it's very limited. And I think what architecture does, which is why I love architecture, is that the connection to our history, and to not allow things to be forgotten, but to be unearthed, remade anew is very important.
All the more important, given that I think it was in a speech in Senegal, in Dakar, President Sarkozy, you know, Monsieur Francafrique, the former president, should I say, of France, talked about l'Africain n'est pas encore entré dans l'histoire, something like that. The African hasn't really left his or her footprint in time, in history. A lot of people were very, very angry about that. And they were looking for things to point to. And after a certain, you know, obviously the pyramids and a number of great buildings in Benin, Cotonou, and in Great Zimbabwe, etc., people began to run out of things. Where they said, have the sands of time eroded what we should have left?
Well, I mean, I think that it's very ironic that a colonial power would be kind of saying that, because essentially you can track the incredible structures up to the colonial period.
Yes.
There was incredible building, right up to the Mosque of Jenne, which was built like one of the great monuments. It was a cathedral of the medieval ages. And there were many other structures, the Buganda Shrine. And, you know, I mean, these are extraordinary pieces of architecture that were being made. But the colonial period wiped out systematically the architecture of the continent. It was about a systematic eradication of that empowerment that architecture makes.
Yes.
And really, you know, we're now at the beginning of the 21st century, where African countries are now finally starting to find their feet, their economic strength, and starting to build. So I think that the 21st century will see a dramatic entry back into the history of architecture. I would say that he's completely wrong in that black culture has not made its footprints in history. It has, but it hasn't in architecture. And the victor obviously tries to write the story the way he wants to write the story.
Even to rubbing off the nose of the Sphinx.
Exactly.
So they say, this is the thing. Got an email here from Sabrina. Hey Bonsu, tell David that I'm glad to see he's remembering his roots by being on Colourful Radio today and not on one of those bigger commercial stations. He's laughing out loud. He will laugh when he knows that Sabrina listens to this station. You're looking at me, his eyes are narrowing visibly, his face looks kind of completely nonplussed, and now he's burst out into a big smile. He knows this woman. Yeah.
I think that must be Sabrina Andrew. Yes.
Okay. Well, let's talk about David's history a little bit, okay, seeing as we're on this point. Born in Dar es Salaam, in Dar, in Tanzania, which I visited myself last year. Son of a Ghanaian diplomat, lives in Tanzania, of course, then Egypt, Yemen, and Lebanon before moving to Britain at the age of 9. What were those early years like? And how did this thirst for architecture begin?
I think that, you know, as a young boy, I wasn't one of those families where we were just growing up in one place and that one place defined my sort of my movement. We moved across different continents and different places, and you know, whilst that was really quite traumatic as a young kid, what it exposed me to very quickly was different races, different cultures, and different architectures that define different places. In the Middle East, the way in which male and female space works was very different to, you know, Nairobi, which was a kind of new up-and-coming cosmopolitan place, or new kind of Ghana, which was this new capital city and the way it was kind of growing, right through to Lebanon, which was really the kind of south of France, of the Middle East. It was a Saint-Tropez of, like, the Middle East, you know? So all these kind of places really had a profound effect on me. And I think only later, I didn't know that I wanted to be an architect when I was a young kid. It really came to me sort of through art school and sort of my art teachers, who were like amazing at sort of encouraging me. They really encouraged me. My parents were, you know, fantastic at not resisting. You know, I think like...
So, the usual ones. What other professions did you do?
Lawyer, doctor, solicitor.
Accountant.
No. My parents were like, okay, they somehow realized that I was committed to it. So they encouraged me to pursue it. And I really am grateful to them for allowing me to pursue the arts.
Okay, you had great teachers and your parents I don't know if you had great teachers. But they were certainly...
Oh dear.
Okay, that sounds like a story. But, I mean, did they see something in you? Was anybody saying to you, you're amazing, David, you've got to follow this route? Or did it not really unfold like that?
No, it didn't unfold like that at all. In fact, I was taught by, whilst I was even at school, like in Middlesex, when I was there, you know, one of my teachers was very disparaging of me and said that I didn't actually have talent because I wasn't educated in that sort of middle class artistic sort of environment, which would kind of be the natural trajectory to, you know, becoming an architect or going into the arts, that I should pursue something like sports or the professions. You know, and I think that that is something that is a problem within the art community and needs to be overcome, because even if you haven't had that, you can pick that up. The critical thing is the inquiry that you have in your mind and your desire to be part of the kind of the visual world that makes up our histories, you know? And I think once you have that and you have that thirst, you have to pursue that you know, inquiry and not be put off by, you know, fear about, you know, what you think the profession needs or the world needs or what your connections are within your family to what kind of job you can get, et cetera, et cetera.
Well, when we hear about your history, where you've moved and the fact that your dad was a diplomat and, you know, the way you sound, because people listen now, they think, he sounds very nice. He sounds very good. A wonderfully eloquent guy. People assume that, you know, he's doing Oxford, Cambridge, Durham, all that kind of. You actually got your BA at London South Bank.
At South Bank.
This is the thing, because, you know, just a couple of weeks ago, there was an organization called Elevation Networks, which works with young black graduates.
Yeah.
And they worked out that there were more black students at London South Bank or the University of East London than all the Russell Group universities put together.
Yeah.
And people drew negative conclusions from that. But it doesn't necessarily have to be. If you have a direction and you work hard and you are outstanding in what you do, you then graduated with an MA in 1993 from the Royal College of Art. But what about after that? Because, you know, I know people who want to go into law, whether solicitors or barristers, it's fine doing the academic work at college, university, but it's getting your articles, you know, getting your pupillage, and I presume going to a practice as a young architect and getting the, I suppose, being groomed there.
No, I mean, after getting my MA, the biggest problem was, you know, getting work.
This is it.
But, you know, what is amazing is that I think that, you know, you have to become resourceful. I mean, the irony is that when I graduated, it was in the 90s when the crash had happened, yep. too. There was another economic crash. So, you know, I was working for some companies part-time. I was doing my own thing. I was supporting my friends and communities. I was working in the community. And I think you have to sort of try to be resourceful. I was also teaching at that time. Teaching was really important to me.
Yeah.
But it took many years before I had full-time work and was able to then finally finish my professional sort of qualification to become legally, to call myself an architect, because that word is protected and you have to go through a special exam before you can become an architect. You can't just call yourself an architect because you woke up and start building buildings. It's not possible.
Did you have any role models? We talk a lot about role models on this show and the importance of them.
Yeah.
Did you have one?
Yeah, I had many role models, from the ordinary to the sort of incredible. I had an incredible, my art school teacher, I think, was one of my, you know, everybody has a teacher that was kind of great.
Yeah, I had one as well.
Mr. Jenkins.
Mine was Mr. Moynihan.
Mr. Angus. There you go. Mr. Jenkins changed my life, really.
Wow.
And allowed me to kind of pursue, you know, the career that I've become, that I've moved in. But also people like, there's an incredible architect called Oscar Niemeyer from Brazil, who basically single-handedly, with his, the sort of young government at that time, built the capital of Brazil, which is Brasilia. And he basically went out into the jungle, the Amazon jungle, with a team of people and built, I mean, super heroic, and it doesn't sound real, but in 1927 that's what he did. And he's one of those incredible people to me, that he believed in a new country and a new idea, and he put his hand, you know, he put his heart where his, you know, his thoughts were, and he just went out and did something amazing and has become a kind of a sort of living legend for the country. He's still around. He's 104 years old.
Wow.
He's outlasted everyone.
That's desire, isn't it? That spirit.
That's his spirit to kind of be part of the change of the country. And it's a really beautiful person for me.
One of the things that you mentioned there was how you graduated into a recession. And of course, we've had a double dip recession.
Yes.
And many businesses have struggled and many have gone under. And you yourself have sailed close to the wind yourself. You had to enter into a company voluntary arrangement. Now, what did that mean for you as an architect, for your reputation? Because there was one piece which described you as a showman, and it said downfall of a showman.
Yes.
How bruising a period was that, and how close did you come to liquidation?
Well, it was my first sort of, as it were, business cycle where you would sort of rise and then suddenly have a moment where the world would suddenly fall away and the ground underneath you would fall away and you would have to quickly find new ground.
Mm.
And it was a very scary moment because I'm a professional. I'm not a businessman. I didn't have an MA in business. So actually, that moment was really, really terrifying. What was great about it was that I reached out to professionals that I knew and I got a lot of really good advice.
Yep.
I thought that that article in particular was by a very nasty journalist who wanted to kind of, in a way, sort of almost thumb me as though, you know, I deserved it for
like
being...
Like the rise and fall.
Yeah, the classic rise and fall. And that was kind of to be thumbed for being successful. And all I tried to do was to do my work well.
Yep.
You know, it was a great lesson. It taught me a lot. And actually, it's allowed my business to become much stronger.
Yes.
We're very, very careful about these things now. And in a way, I'm glad it happened very early in my career, because now we're in a very different place.
But when things happen like this, you know, during the recession, and projects get cancelled, the same thing happened to Oswald Boateng. You know, you've got all these contracts, you think it's going to work, and then suddenly someone pulls the plug.
Yeah.
But you can now withstand that if it happens again.
Yes. No, we've learned to kind of, you know, have what we call a war chest. In business, there's a term called the war chest, which is basically your survival as you know. I mean, it's important to understand that you have to save for the lean years in business, that it's not just about the day to day. And that's something that you learn as you kind of develop your business, that it's important to understand that what happens when things go away, because they do, and the world isn't, you know, a continual kind of resource that comes at you. And how do you diversify? I mean, I've learned that actually I can't rely just on, you know, the British economy for my work. And so I'm working in the US, in Asia, in the Middle East, and in Africa. So that one diversifies one's, you know, outreach, so that you can actually be more able.
I mean, you live all over the world, don't you?
I probably now live all over the world, yes.
I mean, look at this.
And do you have offices in different parts of the world? And are you employing people?
Yes.
And how many people do you employ, David?
There's just under 100 people all over the world.
And that's a massive responsibility, isn't it?
It's a very big responsibility,
Your accountant's listening and thinking, David, are you sure about this? 100 people, 100 people, what's going on? You know, I'll say this as from a Ghanaian point of view. About a year or so ago, I interviewed former President John Kufuor.
Yes.
I said, "Mr. President, you look very happy." He said, "What's there not to be happy about?" One was, as in Kufuor was called twice by the people, and then Kufuor stood down having done his job. Why would I not be happy? Of course I'm very happy. I'm satisfied. You look very satisfied right now.
Well, I'm satisfied in the sense that, you know, I mean, I feel vindicated by pursuing the position that I pursued, and that I've been given incredible commissions as a result at my sort of age as an architect, and I feel really honored by that. And I feel like, you know, that is something that's a great privilege, and I can't take that lightly. And so that's why I guess I'm happy professionally.
You are.
If you, David, didn't have the National Museum of African American History and Culture under your belt right now, then I'd imagine that if I asked you what is the dream commission, you may have said that.
Yeah,
I don't know.
I would have done. Okay. I would have said the arrival of something like that would have been my dream commission.
So in the, you know, as we know, you do have it under your belt. So what now? What is the dream commission post this?
I know, this is a really tough one, but I'm you know, I've started, I'm opening an office in Accra. Which is kind of amazing, because in the past few, really I would say the past year, I've been getting increasingly a lot of work on the continent. And what's been interesting to me about returning to the continent as part of my practice is that there's a lot of master planning, there's a lot of dreaming about what these future capitals can be as they kind of gain wealth. And I think that that's my new dream, is to be part of that. You know, as well as being part of like helping communities in Europe and helping communities in the US, you know, this, my new passion is also to kind of now be engaged with communities in the continent.
This is great, because of course I went to your exhibition about a year and a half ago at the Design Museum, in which you had taken photographs of buildings in 49 African capitals. The one you swerved was Mogadishu. Some people said, don't come.
51, actually.
Yes, indeed. People said, don't come. That's right, isn't it?
Well, it was Mogadishu. You know, Mogadishu has hurt me, and I really want to go to Mogadishu, and I think hopefully it will change. But I managed to photograph over 11 years all the 51 capitals of the continent. But Mogadishu still was at war, and what I wanted not to do was to go to a place where there was still war, because in a way, the idea of the city at war is not the same as a city that's acting under some kind of governance, which is about civic society in some way. So I felt obliged not to kind of record a city that's in that conflict situation, and I look forward to that time when Mogadishu, because I think that, you know, Somalia is an amazing country with incredible potential, and I think when it finally comes out of that horrible situation, it'll be a real engine in the continent.
Excellent. We're going to wind up in a moment, David. I know you do have to disappear to build another, you know, edifice. That's but we've had an email from Toyin who says, an inspiring approach. I believe your guest's decision to recognize the need to fuse an element of history with design is a skill lost in modern architecture. Architecture, contemporary but with roots. Well done. And then he wants to know, what is David's traditional name?
Yao Ajay,
which means you're born on
Thursday.
He's born on Thursday. I am Kwame, born on Saturday. She is Juju, born in Acton
on a Thursday.
No, born on a Thursday. It's 9:34. This is Breakfast on Colourful.
Thank you so much for having me here. I love this station. This is one of the most important stations in this country. So let's kind of support this station.
Beautiful.
Oh, thank you.
You're listening to Colourful.